In a room this small, if you can't hear me without this, I better throw in the towel. I'm going to put it down. Is there anybody who can't hear me? Good. I appreciate the introduction. Actually, we have in the room here with us the guys who helped to think through the problems and make this committee work and make its work product stand up to the test of some of the challenges we from time to time meet. And one of them is Craig Stubblebine, who just spoke to you. Another is the fellow who introduced him, Clay LaForce. And another is the gentleman who will speak at dinner time, Bill Niskanen, all of whom joined with us back in 1972 and 73 as members of the Governor's Tax Reduction Task Force. We have a long time together in the vineyards, and maybe some of the plantings that were made at that time will, by November the 7th or 8th of this year, have borne the kind of fruit that we have been hoping for some time. It's a long and arduous process to amend constitutions, and that's what our committee has been up to and what we've been devoting ourselves to. The constitutional tax limitation movement, I think, did find its genesis in those early days of the Governor's Tax Reduction Task Force. And my role was really that of a catalyst to reach out around this country and find the best economic and other minds that we could lay our hands on to help us in a task of addressing the problem of taxes and spending, which, as one looks at the problem, seems to have been spiraling upward inexorably for at least the last half century. And it was with the good offices of the gentleman I mentioned, and Milton Friedman and Jim Buchanan and others, that we designed what became Proposition 1 on the ballot here in California in 1973 at, as you'll recall, the special election the governor called. I won't agonize with you over the reasons for its failure at the polls rather narrowly in November of 73, but simply say that what groundwork and foundations were laid at that time are now moving around the country. I really do, in the midst of a lot of hand-wringing and consternation that many of us devote ourselves to from time to time, have some fairly good news to report, and that is that this tax revolt that is spoken of in the press on a widespread basis has some substance, and we are making some progress. This afternoon, what I'd like to do is to break the presentation into basically two parts. One, I want to talk with you about the general background of where we are and why the constitutional approach is essential. I think Craig, in his remarks, underscored many of the reasons. I'd like to comment on those and touch on those. And then I'd like to launch into the difficult and thorny business of trying to build or construct a responsible amendment to the Constitution of the United States, which will in fact lead to constraint on the growth patterns, a reduction in those growth patterns, and some meaningful impact on the problem which plagues the nation by the widest margin to all of the citizenry, and that is inflation, and see where that impacts. Now, if we were 300 of us in the room, then I'd make the pitch and we wouldn't have interplay or exchange. But since there aren't 300 of us and we have the normal compatibility of a Philadelphia society gathering, and I've been happy to be a member of this organization virtually since its founding days as an old member of ISI when we called it the Intercollegiate Society of Individualists. And we do have a format here for exchange and interplay. So at any time, please don't hesitate to yell at me, raise your hand, object, disagree, or whatever. And I think we will maybe enjoy the afternoon that much more. But let's go through a little bit of history and talk about what has been going on. Post-Proposition 1 in California, I wandered about the country and chatted with people and urged the approach of constitutional tax limitation. And the discussions that Craig has had with people and Bill and others over time led to a sufficient level of interest nationally so that in 1975, Bill Rickenbacker and I got together and said, hey, we have to have some organizational vehicle through which to help out in this process and to give some shape and direction, at which time we formed the National Tax Limitation Committee. About that time, as a matter of fact, a little bit earlier, we had the pleasure of meeting with a couple of state representatives. One of those is State Representative Dave Copeland, who fought in his state of Tennessee for some 3 to 4 years, and finally last fall got an amendment through a constitutional convention in Tennessee at a crucial point in time when the 18-man tax committee of the Constitutional Convention was deadlocked 9-9. Late on an October afternoon, we arranged for Milton Friedman, who has been with us from the beginning and on our board and deeply enmeshed and involved in this effort, got him on an amplified telephonic hookup from his hotel room in New York, and he spent an hour speaking on the loudspeaker to that committee, a meeting in Nashville. And it was well attended with members of the press, so there was good general visibility of that activity. And that broke the logjam. And the tax committee then voted, put it out on the floor, the convention voted for it, and on March the 7th of this year, the citizens of Tennessee, by a 65% vote margin, approved an amendment to their constitution that basically says this: the rate of growth in taxes and spending in the state of Tennessee shall not be at a rate greater than the economic growth rate of the state as defined by law. Now, there are other features, too, that help kind of in a total weapons system constrain things. Now, that's not as tightly a drafted amendment as some that are on the ballots right now in Michigan, Colorado, elsewhere. Under the circumstances and in the political realities of the state of Tennessee, however, with their historical, with their precedents of a little more conservative reaction by their legislature, this device has and will be a solid and sound control device. As Dave Copeland explains it, it's already been the source of restraint on spending practices in the state of Tennessee on two or three occasions when it was raised as the reason for not passing certain legislation. And Dave and the Speaker of the legislature of the House there in Tennessee had already agreed on the econometric model that they would build into law, which would then be as defined by law and the growth of the Tennessee economy. So that was state number one, all 50 states, to enter upon the arena of constitutional limitation on taxes and spending. Of course, 13 came along and tremendously raised the visibility of this entire combat, and we're eternally grateful for that. Some of the other fallout effects, I'm not sure we're eternally grateful for. But be that as it may, it has moved a number of things forward. Now, in the state of Michigan, after laboring for some 4 years, it looks like we've got a chance at having an amendment adopted this November, one that is thoughtfully developed. Bill Niskanen worked long and hard on it. I think Paul McCracken shared some drafting responsibilities. And it's a sound tax limitation device for the state of Michigan. It was put on the ballot by the initiative process. As a matter of fact, it was on the ballot in a somewhat similar form in 1976 and lost narrowly at the polls for some of the same reasons that we lost in California, although a lot of lessons were learned, but primarily because of inadequate support, inadequate funding by the business community that really has the resources. Now, in conversations with Jim earlier today and with some things that happened this last week, I'm seeing some changes in the business world that are very encouraging. A little aside for a moment on large corporate enterprise and the relationship to issues of this kind and politics generally. I've tried to analyze why large corporate enterprises, by and large, stand aloof of this kind of effort. Why in 1976 they did what they did in Michigan. Why we're still having the same kind of problem with the big three in Michigan. One has to say that given just a very clinical self-interest viewpoint on this, or analysis on this, that that the large corporate enterprises have as much to gain by putting a limit on the capacity of government to tax and spend as anybody. But they have stood aloof of this battle until just recently. I suspect that many of the largest of those, maybe those that stand in front of DART Industries, maybe those that are 100th and then 50th and 12th in the Fortune 500, feel that they control such an aggregate of wealth and that they have positioned themselves in such a way that they don't want to disturb the situation, that they think they, in fact, can control their destiny by their own devices, and that they make their own bets and side deals with whomever it may be, whether it's a liberal politician that controls a key committee or whatever it may be, and to get involved in this kind of fundamental change in the way that we do business in government may frighten some of them. Of course, large corporate enterprises, we have to recognize, are under the guidance of people who almost inevitably have no equity interest in those companies, who are managers, who are paid salaries, and who do not have the same depth roots that an entrepreneur who has created that entity would have. And they don't necessarily project the same kind of attitude. As a matter of fact, I think in many cases, managers of large enterprises feel much more comfortable interfacing with leaders in government, government bureaucrats, and et cetera, than they do with the entrepreneurial types. Fortunately, that rule has enough exceptions so that we are seeing some of the large enterprises entering the field in an effective and aggressive way now in support of this kind of movement. And I think what DART is doing is an outstanding thing, and to get in and really begin to work with a reservoir, for example, of 22,000 employees and exert the kind of influence which an employer can when he does it intelligently is incredible. I gave a talk Thursday in Seattle to the Association of Washington Business annual luncheon, and proudly announced that the Boeing company had made a decision, breaking a 12-year policy, to take the initiative petition of petition 62, initiative 62, under Washington law, which is now being circulated for signature, and to actually circulate it inside the companies, on the assembly line, in the cafeterias, etc., and get involved. And forget all this nonsense about playing a kind of a moderate, take-no-position role. They are going to take a position and get involved. So there's some very, very positive signs, I think, in that regard. But to carry on in terms of looking about this nation and talking about the good news that is abounding, the battle is on in Michigan. There's one in Colorado, a spending limit on this November's ballot. In the states of Arizona, Texas, and Hawaii, there are Tennessee-type provisos before the people to be voted on. I mentioned the state of Washington, where an initiative petition is on the street now gathering signatures. Under their law, it's not a constitutional amendment. It is only a statutory initiative, which, however, forces the legislature to act once they acquire the necessary signatures. So it has a positive preparatory value to it in the state of Washington. Utah, in the same situation, a statutory initiative, gathering signatures at this very moment. Other kinds of things on ballots are in Oregon, Idaho, and Nevada, 13 clones, you might call them. In Oregon, it's exactly, it takes to Oregon all the same drafting inadequacies that 13 possesses, and they'll have to deal with. They didn't even sit down and think through a couple of the problems. Only they changed it from a 1% of fair market to 1.5% of fair market. But Idaho and Nevada have made some adjustments or changes in the wording Arkansas has on their ballot a measure that will eliminate the sales tax on food and drugs. And so it goes across the country. There are a number of states that are doing something, but at least five, as we mentioned, that are going after the total picture of putting a lid on the total capacity of government to tax and spend without focusing on one revenue source, without focusing on how the money is spent, but looking at it in an overall situation. I think the polls, too, are now revealing that people are sufficiently fed up. As we take polls around the country and talk to our pollster Bob Teeter of Michigan of Market Opinion Research, he says the things that are motivating people most directly at this moment in time are really two. One is totally fed up with waste, inefficiency, corruption, etc. in government, and wanting to do something about it, and believing that you can carve out directly out of government budgets at any level between 10 and 25% without getting to the muscle, without really affecting, in a serious way, the delivery of public services that people really want and need. That's a perception that is abounding the land right now. The other major thing that people are seeking is to send a message. Send a message to government that we are not going to put up with this nonsense anymore. Let's drive a stake in the ground. Let's let them know that we're in charge. We're in control. Now, what 13 has done psychologically is very, very important in the process that we're involved in, I think. 13 provided an assurance that there is a method that people can grasp and get their will done and send that message. It's a transmission system, a delivery system that provides a means to send that message. Rather than a historic approach to taxes and spending, which has been hand-wringing, screaming, writing letters to your editor, writing letters to your congressman, and from time to time building bonfires and burning your tax bill, there's now a delivery system. For how many ages has man yearned to go to the moon? That yearning was unsatisfied until somebody built a missile he could sit in and get him there. What a tax limitation amendment is really all about is simply a delivery system whereby our frustrations and concerns, whether premised emotionally or intellectually, can find a means of firmly and in a no-nonsense way getting our will done under a society hopefully continued to be ruled in some measure by law and by constitutional restraint. I think the days of Proposition 1, if we were to put them in perspective, was simply wrestling with the design of a missile that would, when you're shooting for the moon, get you to the moon and not Mars or some other place. And we've been wrestling with that ever since. We've been going through the design process again and again and again. And on the ballot in Michigan is one approach, on the ballot in Colorado is another. The one embodied in 62 in Washington is slightly different. We keep working on these. Hopefully we keep improving these as we go along. And hopefully as we work as part of a federal amendment drafting committee, all of these lessons will be useful to us in coming up with the best possible design that we can be provided with at this time. Now, I could bore you with a lot of statistics, and I don't think I'm going to do that. I think most of us understand that we are being killed by taxes and spending over the fairly near term, over the last half century, where from 1929, government at all levels took but 12% of our earnings. To today, depending on how you measure it, we're at the 42 to 44% level at federal, state, and local. And that process has moved at such an accelerated rate that we're seeing all of the fallout problems that the day-to-day we agonize over. But when in looking at some of these various facets, I think that they're relevant for our discussion here in trying to ascertain the quality, the depth, the degree of the tax revolt that is running across this country, and to determine how long it will run, what the support base is for it, the depth of concern of the people over the long term, whether interim setbacks this November or other interim setbacks will serve to deter that momentum, and to what degree. And it does seem to me that as we look down these sets of factors that are at work, that that we have a basis and to soundly believe that we have some solid momentum. I like to liken the tax revolt in this way. I think it's a forest fire, not a fast burning forest fire, but it's one that is burning on some solid fuel. Proposition 13 was a hot spot, a flare up. Proposition 13 hit some dry grass. The sky was lighted. Everybody saw it. It's died down a bit. It has broadened the front of this forest fire, but it continues to roll in what I think is some pretty solid fuel. It is not only the fact that people respond to polls of the kind that Bob Teeter constantly runs in the way that they are doing, but it is the fact that we do have constant evidence of corruption in government and waste in government. The GSA scandals, the thing on the front page today, as the Democrat leadership in the United States Congress succeeds in simply censuring instead of Korea-gating out of the Congress certain Democrat members who took money, et cetera. But it is this constantly unfolding drama of corruption in government, which I think from day to day continues to support this. It's some stagnation in the development of our otherwise expansive economic pie. It is the obviously the increase in interest rates, the whole inflationary spiral. As a matter of fact, when one analyzes the relative desirability of a Kemp Roth approach versus a tax limitation approach, which offers some potential for inflation curbing. The people are voting 9-1 in the polls for addressing and curbing inflation over a tax cut. It is by a significant margin that is the top economic concern of the people. The growth in government employees, the growth in their salaries. At this time, the ratio between federal employee salaries and the private sector is just outlandish. Better than $16,000 is the average federal salary. Just over $12,000 is the average private sector salary. A total reversal of the historic relationship between the salaries, given the sinecure which government employees enjoy under this incredible array of civil service protections, which I am very much afraid the bill that the president signed yesterday is going to have very little impact on. I don't think there's much meaningful change in the protection devices of the civil service situation. I think two people are coming to understand as you get articles like U.S. News and World Report's article, and they actually had this on the cover of the magazine, and they called it the Gold Coast on the Potomac. And you see the ever-increasing rate of concentration of trade associations, business representatives moving to Washington, this incredible rash of the building of new high-rises that are leased out for 2 and 3 years in advance because everybody's moving their headquarters to Washington to get near where all the power is. When you look at Fairfax and Montgomery counties as the highest per capita earning counties in the country now, the bedrooms of Washington, D.C., all of these factors, I think, underscore the intensity of knowledge and concern about people all over the country. And the attitude expressed by people in Washington who are part of the governmental apparatus, elected or appointed, serves to further support that. I think we have virtually a comparable situation to Versailles prior to the French Revolution in the attitude of many of the people there. It's just keep on sending the money, folks, from Keokuk, Iowa, or from Petaluma, California. Just keep on sending the money, and we'll We'll keep on creating the programs and the boards and the commissions, and we know best how to do it for you. All of these things in the aggregate, I think, give substance to the tax revolt, but we should not overestimate it by the same degree. We should not create false expectations. I do believe, and I've tried to remain uncritical of others that are deeply enmeshed in the tax revolt across the country, whether it's the National Taxpayers Union working on balanced budget, whether it's Paul Gann's effort, which is going, I think, very nicely now in California on a spending limit effort, whether it's Howard Jarvis's effort, or any of the others. Not to be critical. I just hope that Howard, though, in his seeming interest in being on front pages and on TV and endorsing all candidates for all offices, I hope that the fallout result of this is not to create false expectations, as if these things can be done overnight. Now, there wouldn't be an opportunity to win in Michigan in 1978, in my judgment, unless for 4 years guys have been laboring, working at this, trying to get it done. We wouldn't have it on the Colorado ballot this year unless 2.5 years ago a group got together and began the process, the arduous process of drafting a responsible amendment. These things don't happen overnight. And if we create false expectations that we can get this done overnight, we're in trouble. We have to engender in people a duration complex. We're in this thing for the duration of the war, and they've got to adjust their mental outlook so that they're ready for setbacks, undeterred, regroup, and move ahead, because we're going to have some as we go. And we've already had some, and we know what they're like. Now, a little later on, unless somebody has some questions now or some thoughts to offer on it, we might want to touch further on the depth and perspective of this tax revolt. But I think that kind of fleshes out the dimension of it as I see it, as I wander across the country, as I do on a quite frequent basis. Now, I'll add this. There is by no means the intensity of concern in Arkansas or Oklahoma about taxes that there was in California on the 6th day of June. I mean, it's not even the same ballpark. And the only reason, really, that I can get some interest in the board of directors of the Manufacturers Association of the state of Oklahoma is because we're now working at the federal level, and they're concerned about federal taxes. But they think they've got their house pretty well in order in Oklahoma, and when you look in a relative sense at the tax burden of Oklahomans, they're right. And there is no disproportionate sharing of that burden on one particular tax, and there is no perception by the people that one particular tax is out of whack. Now, in Boston and South Boston, it's a different story. In certain portions of Northern Virginia, property taxes have grown the same way that they've grown in California. You get the hot spots around. But again, the intensity of the concern around this country varies dramatically. It focuses on different kinds of taxes in different places. By no means does it focus at all times on the property tax, although in a general sense, when you poll people, you find that the property tax is the most sensitive tax to most people most of the time, wherever you're looking at that issue, just as a matter of actual fact. But again, to put this tax revolt thing in perspective, we've got to recognize these significant disparities in attitude and intensity across the country. Now, I think Craig, in his remarks, laid out the basic analysis for why our political apparatus, our governmental structure, seems to have gotten so far out of whack, and that we seem to be in a point in our political history where the current arrangement of political constraints are ineffective in stopping this growth in taxes and spending. So I'm not going to go beyond his remarks in terms of contrasting the special and general interests. I think we all know the agonizing problems of trying to knock out a given bureau or agency or program once those constituencies develop around that program, whether they be the bureaucrats who implement it, or the private sector people who sell it goods and services, or the so-called clientele that receives the services from it. And I tell you, you go into the hearings and you go into the legislative process, and you just, no way, head on, you're going to stop those programs. And we've been through it, as part of the Reagan administration. I've seen it eyeball to eyeball, and I think we've all seen it. We all understand that dimension of things, that at a given point in the political process, at the crucial decision-making time, that aggregate of force can bring more force to bear to preserve its position than all of us wearing our general interest hats has the time or interest in bringing to bear to knock it in the head and to defeat it. And we repeat that process by the thousands of programs and hundreds of bureaus, and we've got the growth that we see. One of the other elements, and Craig did mention this too, but I want to touch on just a slightly different facet of it, and that is the question of the demand for public services. Politician after politician will tell you, look, you may think we can live in a world in which taxes are limited, but boy, I get all this demand for these programs and these services. How do I respond unless we've got the money to do it, et cetera? And of course, the underlying problem is no price tag on those services. How do we ration scarce resources without a price tag? At zero price, how many automobiles do I want? I don't know. I probably would build a larger garage. But what we've got to do, I think what we have to recognize is simply this. Even if we were a superman and could allocate prices for public services in a fair and effective way, we would still not be able to diminish the demand in the same way that you could in a market context, for a couple of reasons. One is you probably wouldn't get the price tag set anywhere near their real cost to that particular individual. And I think secondly, as we look, and this was one thing that Craig was talking about earlier, I think he was mentioning, if I picked up the argument properly, that if we better allocated the burden of taxation, and assuming people relate the cost of services to the relative burden that they bear, or the demand for the services to the relative burden that they bear, that this would better suppress what otherwise would be an inordinate demand. But I think that the bottom line for most people is that even though they may know that they pay X for some given arrangement of services, at the moment of truth, they think the particular service that they are seeking to have increased is really paid for by somebody else. So that what we're really dealing with in a constitutional limitation arrangement is we're recognizing that the delivery of public services is an unartful delivery system, and we're going to substitute an artificial constraint device that is a substitute for the market mechanism. We're going to describe a bottom line. We're going to say, here's what you get, government, and no more. Do the best you can with it. Extract the dollars in the most responsible way that you can. Deliver the dollars back in the most effective arrangement of programs and delivery services. But here's all you get, a certain defined quantity of dollars. And that there is really no magic in the dollar figure that draftsmen select when constructing a tax limitation amendment. Essentially, you take your victim where you find him. You take government and the expenditures where you find them now. Now, the transformation that has occurred over the last 1 year in terms of public perception of this whole business, I think, is simply this. Our victim a year ago said, put a lid on it where we are, roll it back modestly. The victim today, in the wake of 13, says, chop it a bit. Maybe chop it a lot right up front, and then roll it back over time. We have a slightly different world than a year ago, and I think 13 has produced that world. We find an anomalous situation to some extent. In the very careful drafting that was done, and this is a closed meeting and a non, we don't have any press here or anything, and we'll share some thoughts that if the lead time requirements on drafting an amendment, the one that's in Michigan, were not so great, then going through the initiative process, and if Bill could design it today, and the others who worked on it in Michigan could design it today, they'd probably have an initial cut right up front in that amendment. Whereas a year ago, it was designed to take the victim as we find it, all right? And that's the change that has happened. That has produced some interesting political challenges in the campaign in Michigan, all right? But that's where we are, and that's the real world in which we are operating. Now, that's touching a bit on the business of why do taxes and spending, why do they seem to be inexorable? Because of the peculiar development or evolution of the political process in this country, I think, over time. Why can only a constitutional restraint get the job done? Because we constantly get the argument, especially from legislators, well, look, this is something that we ought to do statutorily. It's too much of a straitjacket to do it otherwise, and let's just have a statutory limit. And, of course, then we remind them of the efficacy of the federal debt limit, which is annually adjusted to meet the exigencies of the situation. And then they throw back at us at the federal level, well, look at these new budget controls that we've adopted, that Congress is imposing on itself. And we've noted, of course, how effective those have been in constraining the federal government's proclivity to tax and to spend. But this straitjacket argument, I think, is best addressed by simply referring to other parts of the U.S. and state constitutions, particularly the First Amendment. And it's very simple and straightforward. All of us, the Founding Fathers, as our predecessors in this ball game, decided that there were certain areas of human action that were off limits to those whom we elect. Speech, assembly, religion, those areas. Many other areas as well, but those immediately come to mind. And all we're doing here, in invoking a constitutional restraint on the aggregate amount of our income and wealth that flows to government, is to say, beyond that number, whatever it works out to be, keep off the grass. That's sacrosanct. You may not invade it with legislative enactments. Those funds are ours to spend as we see fit. So the straitjacket argument, I think, in the face of the arrangement of powers and the relationship of a people to a government limited by a written constitution, that argument, the straitjacket argument, falls quickly. And I think we've found that comes to be recognized quickly by the people, and they now say, in response to that, and as they see the mechanism or delivery system of a constitutional amendment unfold, they say, by golly, that we can rally around, and that's why they are rallying around it. Now, in all of this, it's essential, I think, to identify who are the opponents of constitutional restraints on taxes and spending, and why are they opponents. I think the who is an adequate description of the why. And we've seen this eyeball to eyeball in the California fight on Prop 1. We saw it in Michigan in 1976. We're seeing it in Michigan today. We're seeing it in Colorado today. We see it everywhere. The cutting edge of the opposition is the education lobby in this country. And that as a part of a larger phalanx called the public employee unions and associations. Now, it's by no means that all who hold those positions oppose these restraints, or that all who are involved in those enterprises no longer view themselves as professionals, as career people. The vote on 13 in California is instructive. There were lots of public employees and educators who first thought of themselves as taxpayers and who secondly thought of themselves in their tax recipient role. But the leadership of these organizations, both philosophically and in every other way, are entirely opposed to the thought of limited resources, flowing to the public sector. Jerry Werf, his operation, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, 14 years ago had 240,000 members. Today it has 1.2 million members. It is the largest single part of the AFL-CIO. In July in Las Vegas, following the 13 vote, they virtually declared war on the tax revolt, indicating that they were going to spend many dollars and lots of human resources to endeavor to nip in the bud this tax revolt, try and demonstrate that it has no substance, strength, or depth. And they're doing their best. They are pouring money and manpower into these campaigns in opposition to tax limitation and other tax cut measures. Colorado Education Association bald-facedly is up front in opposition to the Colorado Amendment. The Michigan Education Association in 76 was not quite as overt. They used as their interference the League of Women Voters. They put them right out front as the visible opponents to the tax limitation proposal. But 2 days after the defeat of Proposal C in 76, crowed loudly in the Detroit News and Free Press about the fact that they were the brains behind and the money behind the campaign against the proposal. Now, I personally, from what I've seen of these operations, consider them to be the toughest, most professional, most vicious, worthy opponents on the American political scene today, wherever they happen to be. I think there is an interesting transformation occurring in American politics in the union movement. It was first recognized publicly by the Wall Street Journal in an editorial in June, in which they basically concluded this: the AFL-CIO cannot for much longer carry water on both shoulders. On the one hand, they have the historic private sector unions that they have worked with and that has been the base of the union movement. Now comes the emergent public sector unions. And of course, you can't give a raise to the public employees unless you tax the private union guys more. And they're the guys who largely are without tax shelters and other ways to avoid the direct impact of any tax increases. And what you've got at work in the labor movement in this country, and we who believe in limited government are crazy unless we exploit that schizophrenia to the maximum feasible extent. Now, we know that we can exploit it because we have exploited it on an ad hoc basis at the local level, at the local union level. In Michigan, for example, downriver in River Rouge was Walt Chesney, who, as president of the Steelworkers Local, personally gathered 1,100 signatures on the petitions in 1976, all right? At the Little League games and at the stands at the soccer and at his bowling league and all the rest, it ran like the litany of individual action in a political sense. And we saw this all over, individual union members, damn sick and tired of this whole business. So the opportunities are there. There isn't the slightest question that a little adroitness on our part can exploit this situation to its maximum. The AFL-CIO, with an 84-year-old president in George Meany, is one of these days very soon going to have to address the issue of which side of the labor movement will control the policies and direction of the AFL-CIO. And it's going to be an interesting time. And if those who share our philosophy do not begin to lay a groundwork to take advantage of this target of opportunity, then we're crazy and dumb and stupid and don't deserve to be in the in a leadership role in this effort.
So, any data on how union people voted in California on 13?
I don't think that there was any statistical distinction based upon union or non-union membership. The statistical distinction ran basically by income level and, of course, property ownership. Now, I don't know, someone else may have a more... Yes, sir.
I don't have statistics either, but a friend of ours mentioned just before COVID-19 passed, the atmosphere
about the stories are replete about those large corporations in the state that opposed 13 as a matter of public policy, but who, when they got in the recesses of the boardroom after the individual directors of the corporation had just quickly calculated the reduction of taxes on their home in Palos Verdes Estates or in Menlo Park or in Beverly Hills, they came in and were more than ambivalent on the issue of taking a policy position on 13. So you had this kind of thing that was at work. Yes, sir?
But large corporations did take a position, despite the questioning of many of their board members and their shareholders. I have seen a list, and I presume it's correct. It's a great amount of money, ranging up to $25,000 contributions, was given by great number of large corporations, including one being Bank of America and Broadway Department Stores. I can't imagine them being on the sidelines, depending on the sidelines, but I can't imagine in their own interest taking the position that they have and raising the amount of money that they have to fight something that's ultimately going to
Yeah. Yeah. Well, many of them. Yeah. Many of them simply feared that the reduction on that side of the ledger was going to come back to haunt them in increased taxes to be borne at the local level, possibly at the state level, on business enterprises, whether rightly or wrongly or whatever. We'll know as that sorts out what occurs. And certainly 13 was not as artfully drafted as one might hope, so people could legitimately oppose it given an alternative, given the alternative of 8, split roll aside for the moment, classification aside. But at least there was some choice being offered. But
can I get back to what I was saying?
Yeah.
If you don't have the empirical data, it might be worth either doing that if you're planning to exploit the difference in the union. If you come up with empirical data that shows the split, that's the way to exploit them. That's one of the ways you could exploit them.
Well, I've asked the question, and I don't have the data, but there's no, to my knowledge, there's no statistical distinction. And there's another very important thing. Some black leaders are claiming that the tax revolt is premised in racism. Also, when you look at the data, you do not find that there is any significant difference in the votes by race. Again, it was by income level, a home value, that kind of thing that really spread it out. Doyle? All right, now let me jump here, because this panel is devoted to the federal thing, and we've just been laying some groundwork and probably at too great a length. Let me move now quickly into a federal amendment design and to array the issue choices, because our committee is right in the middle of it. This moment of background. On July 26th in Washington, we announced the impaneling of an approximately 30-member Federal Amendment Drafting Committee. And that committee has now met twice. Let me just highlight some of the folks who are on it. I've already mentioned Bill Niskanen, Craig Stubblebine, and Clay LaForce, who are here with us today. Bob Bork, former Solicitor General of the U.S., now teaching law at Yale. Jim Buchanan from VPI. Bob Carlson, former Commissioner of Welfare at the U.S. level and here in California. Dave Copeland from Tennessee, who led that successful first fight. Jim Edwards, Governor of South Carolina. By the way, we did not want any sitting U.S. Congressman or Senator on the drafting committee, although we have just this week sent letters of invitation to all of them to participate as members of the Congressional Advisory Committee so we get their input in the process. Milton Friedman and his wife, independently of Milton, his wife Rose, who is an economist in her own right, who is participating without having to be guided and directed directly by Milton's own perspective on a given issue, you know, before the committee. Bob Gordon, professor of economics at Northwestern. Alan Grant, president of the American Farm Bureau. Dick Headley, who runs the chairs the thing in Michigan, the Taxpayers United for Tax Limitation in Michigan. Jim Lynn, former OMB director. Paul McCracken at Michigan. Robert Nisbet. We didn't want just to focus in on economists and numbers people. They're obviously essential to working out any decent amendment, but to get the perspective of other disciplines. And Robert Nisbet, now at AEI, formerly at, he was at University of California for a good long while, and at Columbia, the great sociological historian. Glenn Paschal from Washington, he's the executive director of their Taxpayers Association, and represents the National Taxpayers Conference, which is the association of all state taxpayers associations. Bill Rickenbacker, our chairman. Bill Riker, chairman of the Political Science Department at Rochester. Frank Shakespeare, a member of our board and president of RKO, is serving also. NFIB is involved through Kurt Thatcher, director of state and local business operations. Don Totten from Illinois, who's been in this battle from the early days. Charlie Walker, who runs Charles Walker and Associates in Washington, is looked upon as one of the top advisors to business on tax matters in the nation's capital. Aaron Wildofsky, formerly dean of the Graduate School of Public Policy at Berkeley. Walt Williams, professor of economics at Temple, and others. It's an excellent group of scholars and thoughtful people, and we're all wrestling with the problems. Now, look, what are those problems? Let's go through quickly and identify the issues, and you'll see why it's not an easy task. First, of course, is how do you frame the limit? Is it a tax or a spending limit? I think we have general concurrence that it must be a spending limit so that the peculiar opportunity of the federal government to generate money supply is constrained. Bill Niskanen has worked up four or five different alternative approaches that provide, when you work out the numbers, varying degrees of reduction in the aggregate size of the federal government over time. And it's a matter of, I think, as much as anything, public policy choice as to that rollback. Right now, the federal government is at about 23% of GNP, having grown rather rapidly over the last 10 years or so, over the last quarter century as a percentage of GNP. And the discussion, of course, is that at that level, it seriously impedes capital formation, seriously impedes the activities and ability of the private sector, and query rollback and query at what rate, over what period of time, and what devices are used in order to accomplish that. You can, for example, simply say that the expenditures of the federal government shall be this year no more than last year's, except as may be adjusted by. And it's what you adjusted by that describes the story. Is it population changes? Yes or no? Is it cost of living changes? Yes or no? I might say parenthetically, because all who participate concur that government is the source of, and its activities are the source of, that very cost of living factor, that maybe we ought not to allow government to participate in that which it creates as a problem, or over time to reduce the proportion of cost of living adjustments that may be made in order to force government to whittle back on its deficit or on its inflation creation policies. Another major issue is, do we establish priorities in the budget process? There is concern on the part of some that our current and maybe long-term national defense disparity with the Soviet Union is such that we ought to make special provision for the budget for defense purposes and appropriations for defense purposes. If so, how should that be accomplished? Is that counterproductive to the overall desired result, and that is to get a handle on the totality and the aggregate of government taxes and expenditures? An emergency provision. It's clear that some method of addressing national defense emergencies at least must be provided for. Should we go beyond that? Should it be other kinds of emergencies, and what are those? Part of that, of course, is who declares the emergency and by what vote and under what circumstances, and who initiates? The President, the Congress? What is the history of more than majority votes on critical issues in the Congress of the United States? Hence, should that emergency provision be invoked by a 60% vote, a two-thirds vote, a three-quarters vote, a four-fifths vote? A little research on the history of special issues confronting the Congress is required and is being undertaken to see just what has happened, in fact. The question of federal mandates. I think we all recognize that, and is certainly built in as part of the standard model constitutional amendment at the state level, is that higher levels of government find it very easy to impose on lower level of government real-world cost programs for which they don't provide the money. It's very easy. The political income derived by those who vote in favor of a no-cost program that has a real-world cost that must be borne by somebody else is super, and they go back to their constituents and crow about it. We must put an end to that nonsense, and I think everybody on the committee agrees on that, and that we will. There is one area that has been roundly discussed, an interesting and challenging one, and that is, should the private sector also be protected from federal mandates in the form of regulation? We all recognize that a tremendous amount of the cost that has been borne by the private sector in recent years has come straight away from the function of the federal government, the Congress, and the administrative agencies in promulgating rules about OSHA and clean air and this and that and the other things, billions upon billions. And query whether it's appropriate in such an amendment to include that kind of provision, whether that goes beyond the bounds that politically is acceptable, whether that's the subject of some other approach, but the whole issue of federally coerced costs and protection therefrom for state and local governments is essential to a sound amendment, we feel. What about the current share of money which the federal government devolves upon units of government in so-called special or categorical or general revenue sharing? What do you do about that? If there is not some comment, some restraint, some addressing of the issue, you're likely to have the federal government over time try to buy additional revenues to be used in federal programs at the expense of reduction in funds shared with local government. So some kind of constraint in that area is important. But also to view the issue and approach the issue in terms of the implications for federalism. We've already so skewed and screwed up the relationship between the federal government, the state governments, and the local governments in terms of who has what to do and how they derive the revenues and who pays for them and who gets a credit for them, that hopefully, to some modest degree, federal amendment, the shape of the federal amendment will be such as to tend to unravel rather than to exacerbate that problem. But that's a knotty one. It's a tough damn problem. But that is an issue that we're trying to come to grips with. Whether to talk about it all, whether to address the issue of the use of surplus revenues, those that are derived in excess of the expenditure limit, and how to use those is also an issue. The question of enforcement. How do you enforce? Let's assume that you neatly set this up and everybody ratifies it and it's now the law of the land. And you have a limit and everybody starts ignoring it. They just start appropriating more than the limit requires. What do you do about it? And we're trying to determine whether or not to simply say that certain appropriations, in a cumulative sense, beyond the stated limit would be themselves null and void, whether there would be a restraint on the Treasurer of the United States in the issuance of warrants pursuant to appropriations once you reach a certain dollar described level. Who has standing to sue? Any taxpayer? Any of us? Who can take the issue, and whom do you sue when you want to sue somebody to stop people from ignoring the restraints of the amendment? Then, of course, we have questions such as entitlement programs, in or out, Social Security, government pensions, et cetera. I think there's general concurrence that we would abrogate any meaningful limitation if we did not include within the constraint of the amendment these various programs, which are thought by many to be non-discretionary, but over which the Congress obviously has ultimate control. And we've got to include them because the adjustment factors built into the law for these now are such that they are going to take a serious situation and just make it worse over time. And we were so far out of kilter in terms of the accrued liabilities for which there's no funding. At the current rate, as I understand it, the current rate of transfer payments in the Social Security system, the current Social Security Trust Fund, if it were the only reservoir of dollars to be used, would last 9 months. What is it, about $50 billion, I think, in that fund right now. So we're in a transfer situation, a transfer payment situation. And then finally, the issue of automatic adjustments. Whether or not, without some vote of the people or some other way to address it or some emergency vote by the Congress, you do in the face of a United States Supreme Court decision that bears a real-world cost in some program area, make an automatic adjustment in the level, or if there's a transfer of funding responsibility down or up in the process, in the system, you make some automatic adjustment. Now, all I've succeeded in doing is arraying the issues that the amendment committee is trying to address. I think we have concurrence in at least three major areas. One, the limit has to be a spending limit. And I think we have general concurrence that we ought to have some rollback over time. Secondly, we know we have to have a national defense emergency provision. Whether we give priority to the defense budget is another question. Thirdly, protection of states and local governments from federally imposed costs has received general concurrence, and some protection for current revenue shared in some way, shape, or form, I think, is generally agreed upon. Beyond that, the issues remain to be debated and, I think, decided in the committee. That's where we are, and I just open it for your thoughts and discussion and advice and counsel. Bill or Craig or Clay, does that accurately array about where we are in the process from our discussions?
I think the point should be made on federal grants and aid. I think federal grants and aid destroy the federal system. I don't want it. The realistic. Sure. part of the federal budget that goes in the form of grant aid and federal revenue. So there is, we're trying to be politically realistic in terms of the nature of the review and approval process from the very beginning of this matter. And it is very likely to include some features which you personally may not like, in the sense that you may think that you'd like to have more of a rollback. You may think that just assume that federal grants and aid or general revenue sharing or something went away. But remember the nature of the approval process. It takes three-fourths of the legislature, the American states, to approve a constitutional amendment. It takes two-thirds of the Congress of the United States to put one on, put one to consideration of the legislature. So we're looking for wording and phrasing and constraints that will meet very broad consensus. Now, another point. Lou has made, he said how long and how torturous this process is. Josh recognized that he wouldn't want it any other way. In other words, we think we're going to win on this one. We would want any process to change what we're trying to accomplish to be long and torturous.
Yes.
Much more long and torturous than it would be in our case. It is appropriate for constitutions to be hard to change. It's hard for them to change in our favor, but that's the price that we will necessarily have to pay to make it hard to change in the favor of those people who use the power.
Let me add two. There, as you know, there are two methods by which the Constitution of the United States may be amended. All right. One has never been tried, and that is the call for a constitutional convention by the states. Now, the National Taxpayers Union, in conjunction with some other folks, focusing on a balanced budget amendment, has such a call, resolutions for such a call, passed by some 22, 23, 24 states right now. So they're moving in that direction. Our feeling has been this, that while there's enough research to suggest that the call, the parameters of such a conference may be carefully constrained, maybe, that the major concern is who selects the people who constitute the delegates at such a conference or convention. And I think we're all fearful that may be rolling the dice a little too broadly. Now, we may have to do it, ultimately. But the probings, as I mentioned earlier, the probings that have gone on recently in the Congress suggest that, and to some degree of amazement for some of us, that we'll get a much more warm reception than we had reason to believe. Only, I remind you, if we keep the momentum of the tax revolt and the percolation up effect going. And that's one of the reasons why concurrently we have to be aggressive as we can with all the state efforts so that the impact on the individual congressmen and U.S. senators being felt from their home districts and states is intense. But we've got the opportunity in the Congress, and with the kind of people that we've got, the thoughtful people that I think we have on this committee, who to a man or woman are prepared to go into the crucible of the hearings on this amendment downstream and defend it and give the reasons why after the various alternatives this design was selected. Given that, and given some decent internal direction and leadership within the congressional milieu, we've got a decent shot at this. And as Bill indicates, if we've got the goodies for the states to ratify it, build into it, the protection against mandated programs, protection of revenue share and other things, we've got a decent shot at this. Yes, sir.
I'd like to ask something. When you go in to defend this program, you have to say some things that are very different from the things that you've said to us. Because part of the reason that you put forth this program is that you think that political realities will let it pass by, although you may, in fact, some of the members on the committee I know would support a far more radical and far more drastic tax limitation program than the one that you are actually proposing. Now, you are putting forth this program partly for strategical reasons, but you can't tell that to the people you're sitting across, right? If they ask you, well, why did you put this program forth? They says, well, we can get by with this program, but I don't think with the one that we really would want, you would get, let us get away from. So what are you going to tell them that is going to be both honest and effective as to why this program is the one that they should accept?
Now, are you speaking of what do we tell a United States senator and
that's
congressman,
right,
the first constituency we have
that's
to deal
right
with? Well, I don't think, all right, I don't think we've got any, there's no problem in terms of coalescence of design and honest reaction here. We've got a limit on spending, all right? Reasonable men can debate about the degree of cut over what time. And there'll be some, that's where the congressional process will come into play. We may find it strategically as a committee useful to do either of a couple of things. One, have a tougher one than we think we'll get through and stand strong on it and ultimately give in a little bit to one that isn't quite as rough. Or we might present three alternative approaches without necessarily taking a position. They may all reduce by the same degree, but they may come at it a little differently. I don't think there's any question that we would all stand firmly on the business of adequate national defense emergency provision. And I think in terms of sheer equity with the states and local units of government, that we can stand tall on the question of protecting them from federal mandates and costly programs and provide them with a share in the revenue that they've come, most of them have come to rely upon, not as extra dollars, but as dollars integral to their operating budgets. So I don't think we have to prevaricate on that. I think we have to, we will achieve some degree of consensus in the committee, and then within some parameters, I think, the members of the committee may differ modestly, I hope not giantly, differ modestly before the committee. But in those differences, I think we'll build strength rather than show weakness.
There's one other point that I want to make. I want to ask you a question. You will have probably in your audience to whom you're trying to sell this project, whether it be senators or citizenry or businessmen or whoever, you'll have a wide range, you have a kind of continuum. You have people who want to really go all the way out and say, now look, this whole business of even allowing the state to tax that much is giving them too much. They don't deserve that much. They have abused it, and they're going to abuse it the next time, and so we should be much more radical. Then you have those who want to say, look, this whole thing of limitations is silly because the state knows where we are going and it should be empowered to make the decisions and all this limitation is arbitrary and a prioristic. How will you address those who are more in the, who have the first sentiment, who think that you are supporting a kind of a status quo by institutionalizing the present degree of state expansion as sort of the limit, and then it, those of us who might want to say that, well, damn it, the state is already doing too much. How are we going to dismantle it from that if you're going to enshrine it in the Constitution? How are you going to address those?
You raise good points, and you raise another dimension, though, and I think it should be addressed. Given that the amendatory process at best is a long one, both getting congressional action and then getting ratification, we probably should develop, and I think all of us have been thinking in our own ways about this, of a couple of interim features to urge on the federal government that will help to condition the public sector, the federal sector in this instance, and get it prepared for a world in which we have this limitation at work. All right. Now, a way, let me toss out a way. A way might be to say, let's call upon the federal government for the next 3 years or 2 years to tread water in absolute dollars. Okay? The budget next year will be exactly what the budget is this year and allow revenues to catch up. And squeeze out inflation while we're in process. I think there is a tremendous advantage, really, in preparing all of us psychologically and preparing those in the Congress and the bureaucracy, et cetera, to be prepared for this kind of a world, to get ready for it. And I think it's in the discourse on that that we meet the concern that you've expressed. We've got to elevate the visibility of this thing. We've got to talk about these features and elements. And I would hope that this can be done through the corporations in this country who can begin this process with their employees who've already, obviously the ones who, as with Dart Industries and what Jim has done there, who have already started this dialogue and have the confidence of the people, their employees, that their employer as large corporation is not selling them a bill of goods, but that they're all in the same lifeboat together, and we're going to sink and swim together, that they've got the vehicle for the education. I think we've got a hell of an education job to do. I don't know if that fully answers your question, but maybe we get a little bit there. Yes, sir. No, I don't think that we have ever stated, and I hope we haven't, and if we have it articulated in just that way in our literature, we will soon excise it. We are concerned about the aggregate size of government at the state, federal, and local level. We don't think that necessarily a front-end MEDAX approach is the appropriate way to get at it, although it is clear that today's sentiment will accommodate a much greater immediate cut than would the sentiment 6 months or a year ago have accommodated across the country. But we can't necessarily tailor our strategy on the ups and downs, the cyclical ups and downs of public sentiment. As long as we can determine that there is a definite trend line so that we can, in other words, if we geared ourselves to today's immediate viewpoint and tailored the product for today's immediate viewpoint, it might be so far apart in 4 years that we would have doomed the product. So we got to find a general trend line and get with it. But I think the consensus on our committee is, without question, that we build into the adjustment factor the process of rolling back the aggregate proportion which the federal government represents in the total economic pie over time. Well, you know, there's a difference between calling for today's tax cut and tomorrow's constitutional amendment. Okay? And that's the world in which we're dealing. And, you know, we don't claim to have omniscience. And if we need to be kicked in the rear end because we're not moving far and fast enough or whatever, good enough. And that's why dialogue of this kind is invaluable. But there is a difference between calling for today's rapier thrust and tomorrow's long-term adjustment. Yeah, right. Are we ever...
I think
if we look like we're on the right wing or whatever, there's much less chance that we will be accepted by the broad consensus that is required for constitutional change than if forceful, articulate, intelligent people from the Cato Institute or the Philadelphia Society or wherever are making a case that Lou Miller is sold out to the liberals.
From 1973 in the campaign, when we were considered just to the right of Genghis Khan, and they had us draped in sheepskins coming off the steps. You know, who could possibly want to assault the flexibility of government in this way? And now we're the middle of the roaders. I don't know how to act. I just mind-boggling.
Lou, thank you very much, and that was very stimulating. We have some announcements, I think, from Don and Chuck, and if anybody would like to talk to me about Prop 13 and we as a company and what we did since it's public record, I would be glad to talk about the pros and cons. I will tell you this, that we were 100% for SCA 42, the Duke Magian bill, which was in being at the same time as Prop 13, and we're 100% for the GAN spending limitations right now. But there are some other factors during that period of Prop 13 that business had to look at. I'd be glad to discuss it with somebody. I think there were some very logical things. But as individual voters, I voted for Prop 13.
Nice to have you out of the closet, Jim. Just one announcement, or a couple of announcements, please. The reception, this is the most important announcement of the day now, listen carefully, the reception has been moved to the Newport Room, which is down the hall, the other side of the lobby. So please make a note of that.
And who won the game?
The Yankees won the game in the extra innings, 4-3, I think it was. Anyone who has not registered or who is bringing a special guest and knows of a guest coming this evening for dinner, they will need a name tag to be admitted to the dinner. And we do have a special price for those coming only for the dinner. So please see Lee Myers right after we adjourn here if you know for sure that somebody's coming so we can get them counted. And then we do have a special price. They will need a name tag. And then dinner at 7, we'll come back to the same room here for dinner. So thank you all very much.
And I suppose you're well aware of that.